Good morning, everyone. So I'm here today to talk to you about the platinum rule, which is to treat others as they want to be treated. I think we're all pretty familiar with the golden rule. And I'm curious, this is a great graphic. I think it was maybe Lynn who found this. Who was it? It was Emily who found it. The golden rule is treating other people how we want to be treated. And that assumes a universality of our own experience. It assumes that other people want the same things that we want. Whereas the platinum rule says, maybe not everybody wants what I want, so I should maybe find out what they want and try to treat them in that way. The golden rule is essentially egocentric, when you think about it. So why am I talking with you today? Well, after a good deal of observation, reflection, and discussion with others in our group and outside of our group, I came to the realization that we are pretty darn good at the golden rule. And that goes a long way. There are some commonalities. There are often commonalities in the way that people want to be treated. And so the golden rule does go a long way. It's not a bad thing. And there are a lot of positive things that we do, for example, when guests come to visit us. But I also came to the conclusion that we are less practiced at the platinum rule. So I discussed my thoughts with the MOSEY committee, which is our Membership Outreach and Social Events Committee. And folks seemed interested in that, so I suggested we might have an educator come and talk to us about this, but several people asked if I would do it, so speak for them. What I can do is share with you what I have read and what I have heard from members and educators and advocates in those communities, which is what I will be doing today. Now, I will also note that even when most people in a particular group have a certain preference, that doesn't mean it will apply to every individual in that group. No group is a monolith. And so if somebody gives you feedback, if somebody tells you this is what I prefer, even if you've heard that their group in general prefers something different, just go with what that individual is asking of you. Now, you may recall that last year there was an incident here in one of our services. I believe it was during the coffee afterwards. I was gone that day. And it resulted in a letter to the local paper. And a lot of us felt that it didn't reflect on us because neither party was a regular attendee. Neither party was a member. And it's true that we might not have treated others in that specific hurtful way, but I took it as an opportunity to reflect. Do we actually create a welcoming environment for members of marginalized groups? That's a good question to ask. It's a good question to reflect on. Winona has many people who are members of marginalized communities, and I've seen them come in as visitors. I've seen them come in as speakers. But most of them don't join. Most of them don't attend regularly. They don't tend to come back. Why don't most of them come back? Now I'm going to talk a bit about discomfort. And even me talking about it may be uncomfortable or a bit disquieting, and that's okay. Most of us here are members of some privileged groups, privileged categories in society. In fact, most of us are members of a lot of the privileged categories of society. The categories I'm speaking of include things like race and ethnicity, sexuality, ability, education, occupation, socioeconomic status, gender, age, body size, and others. Members of privileged groups do and say things all the time that make other people feel uncomfortable and unwelcome. And this is understandable to some degree, because when your group's way of doing things is the default way of doing things, you don't notice it. You're not going to notice it unless somebody specifically tells you, unless you're specifically reflecting and looking for it. A fish doesn't know it's wet, right? In fact, I may be doing it right now. I'm trying to speak slowly and clearly, but public speaking nerves do get the best of me sometimes, and my natural speech pattern is quite fast. And so I might not always speak in a way that's easy for you to hear. And you may feel like your needs maybe were not taken into account in my speech because of being hard of hearing. And so that's one way where I'm trying to be cognizant of what other people's needs would be, how they might want to be treated in this situation right now, and I'm trying to speak more slowly than usual. If you are hard of hearing, you may have found yourself sometimes nodding along with a conversation that you aren't completely catching, rather than asking people to stop and repeat themselves. Why is that? It's because it makes it uncomfortable for other people when we have to stop the flow of a conversation, when we correct people. Sometimes that's taken as a little bit of a criticism. And so it's really important not to put the onus on the person who is experiencing that disadvantage to always have to speak up, to always have to advocate for themselves over and over again. If we can listen to them and try to accommodate ahead of time, that's preferable. In many situations where they have to change or edit or hide part of themselves. So it might not be trying to just kind of go with the flow even if you're not quite hearing a conversation. It may be something where you have to hide the gender of your partner because you don't want people to know that you're gay or bisexual other minority sexuality. Now, if you are one of the following, or one or more of the following, you're white, you're cisgender, which just means that you are the gender you were assigned at birth, you're male, you're straight, you're middle class or higher, you're able-bodied, you're of a typical body size, and so on, you need to know that people who do not belong in these categories have been uncomfortable in the same social situations where you have been comfortable. All the time. And simply being around you might have made them nervous. Even if you didn't do or say anything wrong, and that's not your fault, but as you use, I think it's something that we want to pay attention to, that we want to listen to, that we want to explore. So marginalized people are regularly entering spaces that are inherently uncomfortable for them. And it's good to ask, what kind of space do we have here? Well, like most places in smaller Minnesota cities, we have a white, cisgender, straight, middle to upper middle class, middle-aged and older, culturally Judeo-Christian, even though we aren't necessarily Judeo-Christian, space. And that's most spaces in the upper Midwest. And that's not a sin to draw on that Judeo-Christian culture. But I argue that we could be aware of how others feel. We should be aware of how others feel when they enter our space. And it's one thing to be that kind of space, that kind of privileged, friendly space, simply because it describes the majority of the people here. We can't immediately just change that. There's no magic solution for that. If someone comes into our space and immediately realizes that they're in a small minority, we can't fix that in the moment. But it's another thing for them to come here and to spend time with us, to see the way we operate, the way we interact with each other, to see how we behave, and to realize that it might be based on the assumption that the default experience is that privileged experience. So in order to become a more welcoming community, we need to avoid operating on the assumption that those perspectives compose our common perspective. We don't need to deny that those are our perspectives, but we just shouldn't assume that they are the common perspective. So what are microaggressions? You may have heard this term before. I have an official definition here from a psychology professor at Harvard, Dr. Daryl Sue, which is, they are the everyday slights, indignities, put-downs, and insults that members of marginalized groups experience in their demeaning way. Now, this makes it sound like these comments are going to be easily identifiable, that they're going to be obviously rude in some way, but that's not true. They're often not obvious, and they can sometimes actually seem like positive or helpful comments or even compliments. So here are some examples of microaggressions. I guess I can read this for you. So they're holding up signs. One person said, the sign says, "Where are you from?" Now, in everyday conversation, we ask people where they're from all the time, right? Thank you. But we do need to be aware that when we are asking people who may be from a different country or who other people might kind of clock as being from a different country, that might feel different to them. So if you actually just want to ask them where they're from, you might need to be a little bit more delicate about bringing up that topic, right? Maybe share where you're from. And then say, oh, where did your family, you know, where did you grow up? Where is your family? Rather than making it seem like I'm targeting you and I want to know where you're from specifically. Because that would be a microaggression. Another one says, you must be good at math. The assumption that Asian people are good at math. And then here we've got a black woman who is kind of carrying this huge burden. Some of these say, you don't have to be that loud. Are you really capable? Actually in charge here? And is that hairstyle professional? So these are examples of microaggressions, and you probably can recognize a lot of these very quickly as being not appropriate. For example, when a black person is told you are so well-spoken, when they have a wide vocabulary, and particularly this compliment is given when they don't use African-American vernacular English. In other words, they don't sound black. The fact that we even call it a specific vernacular indicates that white English is the default, right? You're essentially complimenting them on sounding white. When not you particularly, you, the general you, which communicates that black vernacular is not desirable. And you're complimenting their vocabulary, which communicates that it's surprising when a black person has a good vocabulary. Plus, adults don't go around complimenting each other's English skills, right? So it's also infantilizing in a way. Another example is saying, wow, your English is so good when talking to someone who's from a different, who has a different national origin. Again, context is very important. If the person just told you, I'm learning English, I'm very excited to learn English, you could say, wow, your English is really good. But if their language skills are not the topic of conversation, if all they said is, oh, I just moved here from Ghana, you don't need to assess their language skills. There's no reason to give a judgment. Just say, wow, welcome, that's great. Tell me about Ghana. This one is probably more surprising to people, giving unsolicited advice. So I'm going to ask you, what roles in society are supposed to give advice to other roles in society? I'll give you one example. A leader is supposed to give advice to a follower. Anybody else have an example?
Counselor.
A counselor gives advice. A parent gives advice. Yes? Ah. So kind of an established group member giving advice to a new group member. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? A mentor, good.
A teacher,
yeah. And when we think about these roles in society, we see that there is a power differential, right? More powerful people give advice to less powerful people. And maybe the power is simply that they have the inside info because they've lived here longer. But oftentimes it invokes kind of a paternalistic dynamic. And giving advice makes us feel powerful. When we feel knowledgeable, when we feel that we have some wisdom to impart, it makes you feel powerful, however subtle that is. When it's unsolicited, it's less subtle, right? So it makes unsolicited advice. It boosts our ego. It makes us feel like we have something to impart. And if the other person isn't seeking advice, then we're really giving that advice for our own benefit. Not for theirs. We're not experts on other people's lives, and if they've lived a different life from you, then defer to them on issues about their own life. So if they want advice, they will ask for it. I have a handout in the back that I will give you that you can have that has more examples of microaggressions that are reported by people from different categories, some common things that they say they hear a lot. So I have them kind of back there, divided up. This is from a climbing gym, rock climbing gym. It says, ask before offering advice. They had to put up a sign in this rock climbing gym. And it says, we know it can be tempting to give advice that you think will help a fellow climber. But results show that 32% of women experience unwanted advice in the climbing gym, as opposed to 15% of men. Even if you're giving beta is rock climber speak for giving advice on how to get up a wall. Even if you're giving beta with the best of intentions, it's better to take a moment and ask someone if they would like your help, and if they decline, respect their decision. Sound advice, sound advice. So you may have heard the statement that privileged people shouldn't have a say on issues that affect less privileged groups. And maybe you don't quite understand why, if you're in a privileged group, why your opinion shouldn't be given weight. For generations, general knowledge or accepted knowledge has come from members of powerful privileged groups. Even when research has been done on things like racism and sexism, it was typically done by white men. So powerful people have long spoken for less powerful people. And it's missing a really vital perspective. One example is person-first language. If you've studied special education, disability, you might have actually been formally taught to use person-first language. This is when you say something like, they're a person with autism, or a person with a disability, instead of an autistic person or a disabled person. So person first would be to say a person with autism. The idea is that, where this came from, person first language, was from the mothers of autistic children. They were the ones who started this. And the idea is they didn't want others defining their children in terms of their autism, their disability. And their common statement was, you are not your disability. Don't be defined by your disability. Don't be defined by your autism. But inherent in that statement is the assumption that the disability or the autism is bad. It's not something you want to be associated with, right? They tried to separate the person from the disability. And this sounds great on the surface, doesn't it? But most autistic adults, when you ask them, feel very differently. According to numerous autistic-run advocacy groups, they say, I am my autism. I've been autistic since the moment I was born, and I'm autistic every second of every day, and everything I do is autistic. And I'm cool with that. So don't try to separate me from my autism. You're taking away a huge part of me. And so this is an example where we learn that people who are in disadvantaged group need to define their own narrative. They need to dictate how others treat them and how others talk to them. Another example, I was on an online forum of sociology teachers, and we were discussing teaching about W.E.B. Du Bois's book. It's the N-word, not the terrible N-word, but the N-word that ends in an O. And that's the title of Du Bois's book. Well, some people were posting that a student had, or one person posted that a student had complained that the lecture slide had the title on it during the lecture. They didn't want to see that word up there. And there was a debate, and a lot of white academics were saying, that's Du Bois's title. And saying, no, if the student says they don't want to see that, don't put it on there. Just tell them like I told you. It's a word that starts with N and ends with O that has been used to refer to black people. You don't need to put it up there so they don't have to look at it for 10 minutes during a lecture. And there was this debate here. And finally, I'll talk a little bit about gender pronouns. We use gendered pronouns every day, obviously. Some people prefer pronouns other than he, him, or she, her. They might use the pronouns they, them. Or they might use something like ze, zim. There are lots of different pronouns that people can use. These people might identify as gender non-binary, which means that they don't feel that their gender fits into man or woman. Or they may be agender, all one word, which means they don't feel like they have any gender at all. And there are various other genders as well. And this can be really hard to get used to in certain contexts. We aren't fluent in pronouns that don't align with what our culture tells us we are looking at when we look at this person, right? Our brains, it's a very automatic response. We see a person, one of the first things we do is assess their gender based on visual cues, and our brain immediately tells us that's a he or a she. And it's really hard, we're not fluent in it. And most people are gonna make mistakes. I made a mistake myself in a class. I had a former student come back to present on their master's research. And they use the title mix, MX period, instead of Mr. or Ms. So I said, please welcome Mix Carter. They graduated in 2018 and continued on to grad school at St. Mary's, where they completed their master's degree. He's here today to present about... And they corrected me. They said, they. And I said, of course, my apologies. They are here today to present about... So we're going to make mistakes. Okay. Now, this isn't linguistically new. I'm going to go over just a little bit. Thank you. This is not linguistically new. There's a long historical precedent for gender-neutral pronouns. There are documented instances of it going back to the 1300s, but it may have actually been in use earlier than that. Shakespeare uses the singular they. It was 18th century grammarians who began warning that singular they was an error because a plural pronoun can't take a singular antecedent. Clearly, they forgot that you was at one time only a plural pronoun. They had, and that eventually over time became singular as well. If you're curious, in formal speech, you was only plural, and thou, they, and thy were the singular. So the 17th century you was replaced by thou, thee, and thy. So, or vice versa. Now, we still use gender-neutral pronouns today all the time. A kid will shout up the stairs to me, Mom, someone's at the door. What do I answer? What do they want? Totally normal. That doesn't sound weird to us at all. Common conversation these days, who is that on the phone? Oh, it was a telemarketer. Ugh, were they asking for more campaign donations? So we use they all the time when we don't know the gender of a person we're speaking about. But it is a language that most are not yet fluent in, and people do understand that. So if somebody gives you their pronouns and their pronouns are not what you expected, it's okay that you're not yet proficient at using them. The best thing to do is to explain. I'm not great at using pronouns that aren't obvious to me or aren't part of my language, but I understand how important it is. Tell them that. I understand how important this is, but I'm not great at it yet. I'm learning. And then you can invite them to correct you. Say, please correct me if I miss one. Last year, we had two speakers come to the UU who used they, them pronouns. And I noted many instances after the service when folks were talking to the speaker where they used incorrect pronouns directly to the speaker themselves. And I noticed that neither speaker corrected anybody. That was interesting to me. That told me a lot. It told me that person didn't feel comfortable correcting us, that they felt they had to just kind of go with the flow, kind of like when people can't hear a conversation and they just nod along rather than interrupt the flow. And the more comfortable you are with someone, the more likely you are to say, actually, I can't hear you, repeat that. And the more comfortable they are, the more likely they are to say, I'm not a she, I'm a they. And they were not super comfortable here, which tells us something. So during the coffee, I encourage you to find a partner and practice. And what I want you to do is talk about a person you know, a person who uses any pronouns, but imagine that they use they, them pronouns, and just describe that person to your partner. So I might say, I have a cousin who lives out in Pennsylvania. They are working on a campaign right now, and they're doing a really great job. The cool thing is they get to fly all over the country, they've gotten to meet Kamala, and they're having just this fantastic time. So there you go. I just described my cousin, and I pretended that she uses they, them pronouns, which she doesn't, but it just helps me practice using that. My mom has a favorite barista in her hometown who uses they, them pronouns, and she was worried about that. She was worried about offending this person, so she went up to them and said, hey, Bailey, can I practice using your pronouns? And Bailey's like, yeah, awesome. And she's like, okay, so if I was going to tell someone about you, I'd say they work at Starbucks, right? And so my mom practiced, and this person thought that was the best thing ever. So just be honest, be upfront, be communicative, and just listen to what other people are telling you. And that's all I have. Thanks.